During the Troubles in Northern Ireland, the IRA was waging a violent campaign against British rule. The British built these prisons, the H-blocks, to lock up paramilitary prisoners. In the early 1980s, IRA prisoners held here went on hunger strike, demanding to be treated as political prisoners. This is a film about those hunger strikes. It looks at why they took place and explores the central role they played in shaping today's Northern Ireland. In the mid-1970s, there were hundreds of IRA prisoners in the H-blocks. Many had committed violent acts of terrorism. However, they didn't see themselves as criminals, but as prisoners of war.
There was a cause of conflict. We were discriminated against. We suffered high unemployment. We weren't allowed to express our politics. We weren't allowed to express our nationality, our aspirations, the Irish language. Irish football wasn't reported on TV or radio. It was all soccer. We had one culture imposed upon us. And when we went out to demonstrate for our civil rights, we were beaten into the ground. Now, we were beaten into the ground for political reasons. And the armed struggle was a reaction to that repression. So the IRA's campaign was always politically related. It wasn't criminal. It wasn't people out to line their own pockets, out to rob banks and become rich. It was the armed struggle was fought by mostly working class people in the cities and poor people in the rural areas.
From the early 1970s, IRA prisoners had been granted special category status. This effectively meant they were treated like political prisoners. Rather than wear prison uniforms, the badge of criminality, they wore their own clothes and were allowed to mix freely with each other. But that changed when, on the 1st of March 1976, Merlin Rees, Secretary of State for Northern Ireland in the then Labour government, announced that special category status would be phased out and that Loyalist and Republican prisoners were to be treated as ordinary prisoners.
What they aimed to do was portray the conflict here in Ireland as some sort of criminal conspiracy. And to that end, they briefed their diplomats throughout the world to row in behind this strategy, to use terms that would normally be associated with criminality, such as mafia. They described the leaders of our struggle as godfathers.
All the terminology began to be focused on Chicago-type killings, mafiosa, racketeering, gangsterism, you know, money laundering. All this terminology came to the fore. The reason for that is simple enough. We can enjoy the support of people because we have integrity, dignity, politics, a strategy and a way forward for people. But people will not support criminals. They will never support criminals in the same way they'll support a political machinery. So if you can criminalize whoever is in resistance to you, then in that sense there, you're well along the road to winning.
As part of that strategy, they tried to criminalize prisoners because one of the flaws in their strategy was that they had political prisoners in their prisons. So they decided that from the 1st of March 1976, anyone who was sentenced through the no jury courts would be integrated with all other prisoners and would be treated as a criminal.
But the first person to be imprisoned under the new criminal regime resisted.
Ciarán Nugent on principle refused to wear a prison uniform, and they stripped his own clothes off him, and they tried to put the uniform on, and he wouldn't keep it on. And he says, "You're going to have to keep that on, you're going to have to nail it to my back." And they threw him in the cell, and the only thing that was in the cell was a blanket. And so Ciarán wrapped himself in the blanket, and that was the beginning of the blanket protest.
Before long, there were hundreds of IRA volunteers on the blanket protest, as newly imprisoned IRA volunteers also refused to wear the prison uniform. 2 years into the protest, in 1978, things deteriorated further, as prisoners began a no-wash protest.
The prison administration said, you're not allowed out of your cell to go to the toilet unless you wear a prison uniform. And the prisoners refused to wear a prison uniform. The prisoners sought a compromise that if they just wore a towel around their waist, could they go to the toilet? And each time they did that, they were beaten. So eventually, they poured when their pots were full because the prison officers wouldn't come around and help them empty their pots and provide implements for emptying their pots. They poured the pots out the door, and they then put their excrement up in the wall because they had nowhere else put it. And that's how the No Wash protest started.
The aim of the protest was to force the British government to grant the prisoners political status. The prisoners drew up a list of 5 demands to this effect. The most important of these was the right to wear their own clothes. In 1979, Margaret Thatcher was elected Prime Minister, and the criminal rhetoric sharpened.
The British chose a battleground to defeat the IRA, to demoralise, to undermine the morale of IRA volunteers, and to undermine the morale of a support base, and therefore deal it a death blow, as they felt it could do. So it meant that the political ramifications for success or failure for both the British and ourselves were huge, absolutely massive.
They beat those prisoners for 4 years. They kept them in solitary confinement. They weren't allowed exercise. They weren't let out of their cells. They closed up their windows. They used ammonia. They hosed them down. They forcibly bathed them, forcibly cut their hair with shears. And what went on there was sheer brutality. And it came to a point where the prisoners could take no more, and they decided to go on a hunger strike.
The idea of hunger striking was to pile moral pressure on the British government so they'd be forced to give in to the prisoners' demands. During the strike, Gerry Adams chaired a steering committee of senior Republicans, which was in contact with both the British government and the prisoners.
Were you in favour of the hunger strikes when they started in 1980?
No, I wasn't. I knew, I suppose, all of the main hunger strikers in both Armagh Women's Prison and in the Hitzplocks of Longcash, but we just ran out of arguments. I had been for a very brief period, a few months, in the Hitzplocks of Longcash myself. I had been imprisoned there, so I saw it firsthand, the conditions. And when I was released from prison at that time, I was part of an effort to revitalise the campaign in support of the prisoners. And we tried everything possible to win from the British government what were very modest and necessary conditions by which prisoners would be treated in a humane way. I also had been in prison previously under the old political status regime, so I knew both sides of the coin, if you like. But 6 years into it, with 600 men or so in pitiful conditions, and women in Armagh Women's Prison being treated like beasts, the prisoners had their way. And you know, we on the outside had a duty and a responsibility to support them once they moved on to hunger strike. But I think I said that we were morally, politically, strategically and tactically opposed to the hunger strike at that time.
The first hunger strike started on the 27th of October 1980. Many volunteered, but the prison leadership chose 7 people to go on strike.
Throughout the 53 days I was in hunger strike, your body was always telling me in no uncertain terms that it's missing something. And the thing that was missing was obviously, you know, the energy that came from food. So there's always that sense, but your mind obviously was telling you that the reason why you're on hunger strike.
As the weeks went by, the hunger strikers became weaker. Until 53 days into the hunger strike, Sean McKenna, one of the hunger strikers, could no longer hold down water and was on the point of death. Meanwhile, the British government opened up a secret line of communication with the steering committee chaired by Gerry Adams. Communicating through a go-between, a local Derry businessman codenamed the Mountain Climber, the British said they wanted to reach a settlement.
They said that they would produce a document, and the hunger strikers may find it pretty amenable to change, that they were prepared to be imaginative, they were prepared to be, introduce something that everybody could live with. And they sent an agent to the airport. There was a priest who was a mediator, went and picked up the document. Sean McKenna lapsed into a coma. And on the strength of documents coming, things are okay, things may be okay here. There's a possibility of some form of resolution. The British have given indication that they're going to move to some way along the road here. Medical attention was sought for Sean McKenna.
In effect, the prisoners had blinked first, and with the pressure now off, the British had room to interpret the document in a way that made sure that none of the prisoners' demands were realised.
they decided they would use the opportunity and bury us. And it wasn't going to happen. And in a series of negotiations between Bobby Sands and the senior prisons governor, it culminated with a pretty bland, harsh statement from the prison governor saying that, you know, Sands, unless your men put on that prison issue clothing that I'm setting you down and come out and obeyed by the rules and regulations that my officers determine, you'll be going nowhere. And that was the end of it. We were in the same position as we were prior to the start of the first hunger strike, maybe in a worse place.
They decided to hunger strike again, but this time they changed their strategy. A man called Bobby Sands would start the strike. 2 weeks later, another prisoner would join him, with other prisoners joining at intervals after that. Bobby Sands thought the strike could achieve political status, but the people would have to die in order to win it.
The week before it started, we were at Mass, and I was standing with a mate of mine, and Bobby Sands was there. And he says, "Who have you got to replace me?" And it phased me out a wee bit, because here was someone who was starting hunger strike the next week and wanted to know who was going to be his replacement. And I found it actually difficult to answer that, because there was a sort of finality about the thing, an awful inevitability. And he was totally and absolutely focused. And he knew that I was dodging the... And he says, "Look, you need to get your head around this. You need to understand," he says, "that see, in a couple of months, I'm not going to be here. You need to know who you have, because you're the one who's going to have to move this on." So I says, "Well, you know, if you must know," I says, it's Joe McDonald." And he thought, and he says, "That's a good choice. Joe McDonald would never let you down."
Sands started the second hunger strike on the 1st of March, 1981. But just 4 days into the fast, events took a dramatic turn when Frank Maguire, the MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone, suddenly died, triggering a by-election.
When Frank died, it was just this opportunity, like a lot of other opportunities, and we discussed it and debated it and decided that this would be something to go for. Now, it was a huge ask, because this phase of struggle, we were never involved in elections. We just didn't take part in them. But we felt that by focusing attention on the election, that we could maximise the support. And if we did get him elected, it would be a huge dent in the Brits.
Those who favoured standing in elections won the day, and Bobby Sands was nominated as a candidate. And you have to remember, at this time, Margaret Thatcher was constantly saying that we had no support, that we didn't have any support, that we were criminals and terrorists.
The election took place on the 9th of April, with Bobby Sands 41 days into his hunger strike. He took the seat by a knife edge, but Thatcher remained adamant. No concessions, no political status.
Faced now with the failure of their discredited cause, the men of violence have chosen in recent months to play what may well be their last card.
Bobby was elected as an MP with more votes than Thatcher. Other prisoners, Kieran Daugherty was elected as a TD, Paddy Agnew was elected as a TD. This is in the South. Other prisoners got very, very respectful votes. So our job was to try and win, in support of the prisoners, public support for their demands and move the British government to that position. And the British government always had the out, always had the means of satisfying the demands of the prisoners. But Thatcher, as Bobby said, saw this as an attempt to break the Republican struggle, to turn the prison into a breaker's yard, and the prisoners weren't going to let that happen.
Do you think if he does go into a coma, you would give the authorisation for him to be intravenously fed?
No, he told me not to. It's very, it's a sad thing to say, and I would feel I love my son just like any other mother does, but I wouldn't. I can't. He asked me not to, and I've promised him not to.
He died on the 5th of May, on the 66th day of his hunger strike. 100,000 people attended his funeral. In the by-election following his death, Owen Caron, a member of Sinn Féin, was elected MP after running on a platform to save the hunger strikers' lives. The government's handling of the hunger strike was being condemned internationally, and Thatcher herself was under huge pressure to bring an end to the crisis, as other hunger strikers starved away through May, July and August.
It was catastrophic. It was like living in a permanent nightmare, and you couldn't waken up out of it, and you couldn't waken yourself out of it. Guys that you knew, guys who were up the wing, guys who you'd been with for 4 years, friends, brothers, we were brothers, back at me, we're brothers, like we get up beside each other every year, year in, year out, year in, year out, and done the whole dirty protest and all together. Brothers were dying, and you couldn't get a grip on it. I mean, you couldn't get the fact that you were never going to see Bobby again. You're never going to see Big Tom McElwee. These were my friends. They were in the same wing as me. Joe McDonald was a good friend of mine, you know, by Kieran Dougherty. Kevin Lynch, great friend of mine. They were dead. They weren't coming back. They were off the face of the earth forever.
On the 31st of July, the hunger strike started to break when the family of Paddy Quinn insisted their son receive medical intervention in order to save his life.
Well, I just wanted to save my son's life.
And what condition was he in when you took this decision?
Well, he was unconscious. I think he never should have done that on a strike. He wasn't fit for it.
When it happened once, it made it much more difficult for the families of the other men who were on hunger strike. You had the media camped outside their house. You had pressure coming from the church and from other political parties, asking them, were they going to let their son die or were they going to save his life? And a number of other families also intervened. And instead of the pressure then being on the British government, it switched on to the families. We believed it was an obstacle we couldn't overcome, and we decided that the hunger strike should come to an end.
By the time the hunger strike ended, 10 men had lost their lives. A few days later, the British government announced a number of jail policy changes which conceded some of the prisoners' demands, including the right to wear their own clothes. But to this day, the hunger strikes are shrouded in controversy. In 2005, Richard O'Rourke published a book which made explosive allegations about the second hunger strike. He claims that contrary to Thatcher's Iron Lady persona, on the 5th of July 1981, a few days before the death of Joe McDonnell, the fifth hunger striker, the British government relayed an offer to Adams' committee via the mountain climber. This offer met a number of the prisoners' demands and, crucially, conceded that prisoners would be allowed to wear their own clothes. The committee communicated the offer to the prison leadership, and inside the H-blocks, Bic McFarlane relayed the offer to Richard O'Rourke.
He sent me up a communication, a call, or just a wee letter on cigarette papers. He sent it up to me and he says, I need an opinion on this. So I looked at it, I mean, for the best part of a couple of hours, and I got him up to the window and I shared it in Irish, there's enough there. And he shared it back, I agree with you, I'll write the outside and I'll let them know. Bic McFarlane was totally on board with this offer. And why wouldn't he be? How could you have rejected it? There's 8 men on hunger strike. Joe McDonnell is hours away from death. You have an honourable way out. In fact, it was more than honourable. You could have squealed from the rooftops, we broke Thatcher. Right? None of our prisoners are wearing the monkey suit. We broke Thatcher. Of course we accepted it.
But the prison leadership was overruled. The next day, a comm written by Gerry Adams came in to Bic McFarlane, saying that the offer was to be rejected on grounds that more was needed. All the while, the hunger strikers themselves were kept in the dark about the offer. 2 more hunger strikers went on to die, before on the 29th of July, with other hunger strikers on the brink of death, Adams, accompanied by a priest, and the soon-to-be-elected Owen Caron, went to the H-blocks to meet with the hunger strikers.
A meeting was organised where you met the families of the hunger strikers. As I understand it, they asked you to order the end of the hunger strike. And the next day you met the hunger strikers in the H-blocks. Why didn't you stop the strike?
Well, I couldn't. That's like asking why couldn't the families stop the strike.
Adams told the hunger strikers there was no offer. There was nothing on the table, right? And he led them to believe that he can come off it if you want. He painted a dark picture for them when he went in to see them on the 28th of July, but he didn't say there was an offer. And the one hunger striker who knew about this offer was a guy called Pat McGeown. And before that meeting took place, Pick McFarlane, the OC, grabbed Pat McGeown, said to him, "I don't want you to open your mouth at this meeting." Pat McGeown said this in a book called Biting at the Grave. He gave an interview to a guy called O'Malley, the author. And Bick said to him, "Don't you open your mouth at this meeting. I don't want you upsetting the apple cart." So Pat was silenced. The one man who knew about the offer, the one man who could have said to Adams, "But there is an offer, Jerry." Adams told them lies. End off. Told them lies. Told them that there was nothing on that table. When all along there was, and we now have manifest evidence that there was. It's no longer a case of Ricky O'Ross saying there was an offer and Pick McFarlane saying there was no offer. We now have documented evidence.
In 2009, this document was released on the back of a Freedom of Information request. It's the offer which a government official read out over the phone to the mountain climber, the man who was the link between the British government and the Hunger Strike Steering Committee. The mountain climber's own notes from the period confirm that the prison leadership did accept the offer. On top of this, other prisoners who were in the H blocks and within earshot of Bick McFarlane and Richard O'Rourke's conversation have recently come out and confirmed that they heard both men accept the offer. Yet the committee said no, and the strike went on.
The IRA was pursuing their armed struggle. And to most volunteers, that was an ongoing process. They were not in any way of a view that it should end. However, Adams was. Adams had come to a point where he thought that armed struggle was not going to work, that it was not going to succeed in getting the British to withdraw. And what he wanted to do was to build Sinn Féin up as a political party. Carlin was a proxy H Bloc candidate, but he was a member of Sinn Féin. And the consequence of Carlin being elected was that Adams could then direct the movement down a constitutional road, right? And start to develop Sinn Féin as a political party. Hunger strike ended on the 3rd of October 1981. Within 2 weeks, at the Sinn Féin Ardèche, a motion was passed saying that Sinn Féin would fight all electoral contests in the north from then on out. It was only because Carlin was elected that Adams could say at the Ardèche, "Look, we have an MP here. We can have more MPs. We can have representation throughout the north." So that was the consequences of it.
Sinn Féin is now the largest nationalist party in Northern Ireland, and Raymond McCartney and Pat Sheehan are both elected Sinn Féin politicians. Ironically, if one accepts that the Good Friday Agreement was made possible by the Republican shift from violence to electoral politics, then Northern Ireland's current peace can be traced back to the committee's rejection of the offer and the subsequent deaths of the six hunger strikers.
Did you prolong the hunger strike because it was politically beneficial for Sinn Féin?
No, and I couldn't have, but not only that, those who say that, are simply just making politics of the issue.